Hi, this is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Laurie Elster.
And welcome to All Access Star Trek.
We have a whole bunch of news to cover, and then we will be reviewing Star Trek Discovery Episode 302, Far From Home. But let's start with the news, and the Discovery news hit pretty much right after we recorded our podcast last week.
Yeah, we were joking about, you know, why don't they just announce Season 4? Come on, guys. And then I think literally an hour after our podcast released, CBS announced Season 4 of Star Trek Discovery. So,
Which we knew. Got it.
I mean, yeah, everyone knew. It's just weird how they just, they felt like they couldn't announce it officially until after the season started. It's just something they believe in. I don't know why. For example, we're pretty sure that they've not only greenlit season three of Picard, but they're probably going to shoot seasons two and three back to back.
Right.
But I'm not sure they're ever going to officially say that, although that it may get weird. I mean, they're going to have to announce it event before season two premieres because it'll be in production season three by the summer. And, you know, Patrick Stewart's going to say, oh, yeah, I'm shooting.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the information has a way of getting out anyway, sometimes from just people who see them filming or see signs of filming, but often the actors let it slip, and some actors can be chastised and some cannot. And I'm guessing Sir Patrick falls in the whatever he says, you just deal with it category.
Exactly. Kind of like how Alex Kurtzman blabbed about season four of Discovery a few times. And no one called him up and said, how dare you? You
know, right. Whereas we've seen things disappear from other actors' Instagram posts and whatnot.
Yes. the details are quite simple. November 2nd, they're going to start under strict COVID protocols. And actually, Doug Jones did a panel last week, which we told you about, on Virtual Trek Con 2, and he talked about those protocols. I believe he said he's already been tested twice. Everyone's in quarantine already.
Yeah, that's the 2 weeks Canadian thing. And they're very, very serious about it over there.
Yeah, they're all already in Canada. This is a total side note, but Sonequa did a round of CBS local interviews last week, and one local reporter was making fun of her house because she has all these bookshelves behind her and they had no books. But it's obvious she's in a rental house and it's not her house and there's no books, you know, because, you know, it's just a rental house. And
right.
I'm sure it's furnished, but it doesn't come with books. But they're all they're all in quarantine in Canada in their nice houses waiting to start shooting in November. They're getting tested, and apparently they'll be tested 3 times a week. During production, and shorter production days, I believe.
Well, because they need time for cleaning areas, I'm sure. Like, that eats into the day.
And generally less people on set. And you've all seen pictures of what it looks like on set. The actors are a tiny fraction of the amount of people around a typical set. And they're going to try to control that so that it's just the people that need to be there. And each, I forget what they call them, pods, maybe not
bubbles.
Pods,
I think they're bubbles.
Right. So different bubbles are not going to be able to interact with other bubbles. And
which honestly, like, as someone who used to work in TV a lot and occasionally still does, one of the best things about doing TV production is all that collaboration and camaraderie. So that's going to be a tough one, I think. Like, when you lose that ability, it becomes a little less fun and sometimes a little less creative. So it'll be interesting to see how they overcome that. It's a tough one.
I mean, everyone's dealing with this right now. The people look at all the shows released in 2021 and 2022 years from now and say, these are the COVID shows, right?
Yeah.
These are the shows shot during the pandemic.
I mean, hopefully it won't be so obvious all the time. Depends how they do it. But from what I hear, a friend of mine in Toronto who works on shows like Lock and Key and things like that, they've really got some good systems in place to keep everybody safe and keep production going and make everything happen as close to the way it used to that they could, at least in terms of the final product. But there's more production news, which I found kind of fascinating. If you want to explain it, because you're probably better at doing it in a short version than I am.
Well, the easiest way to explain this is Alex Kurtzman revealed they're getting something called an AR wall, and it's basically a virtual set. It's kind of like a holodeck where you use LCD screens and game engine technology to create a virtual set, and it makes things easier for the actors because they could see where they are instead of just a green screen. And in some cases, you don't even need to go on location, although it won't completely eliminate location shooting. But doing something like they did in Iceland just wouldn't be possible this year. So there's going to be some new technology that they're going to be using. This technology is probably best known for the show The Mandalorian. And I think a lot of people, I mean, people probably don't even know this, is that a lot of stuff you see on The Mandalorian is all shot on set. You know, when you see him go into caves and you're running across some alien planet, it's all done in the studio using this these AR walls. So yeah, it's pretty exciting, actually, for, you know, nerds who are kind of into production, because it creates a lot of new opportunities for them.
And it looks great. I mean, The Mandalorian is a gorgeous show.
Yeah, I mean, they won the Emmy for both cinematography and visual effects. I mean, there's subtle things that you don't think about, but it makes sense. So when you're in a virtual set, as the camera's moving around, the lighting changes and it reflects off the actors. And you don't get that with a green screen. So when you're creating a fake environment, if you want to create those kind of reflections off the clothing and the weapons and the actors, you'd have to then add that in addition to the green screen, whereas these AR walls do that naturally because the light's coming from the walls as if you were in that actual location.
Right. And doing it later takes a lot of time and a lot of money. So this is a smart way to do it. And like you said, it's so much better for the actors to really feel like they're in the place they're supposed to be.
So basically lots of good news when it comes to production for Star Trek after nothing's been happening since February, basically. Yeah.
Well, for anybody doing anything, but yes.
Yeah, for live action.
Right.
When it comes to animation, which we're going to talk about now, you know, those guys have just been chugging along. Mike McMahon did one of those panels at the virtual TrekCon, and he talked about season 2. He's already finished writing the whole season, and they're already recording it remotely with the actors, and it's being animated remotely as well. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm sure the same thing you're going to say. So he talked a lot about, obviously, TNG has been their sort of guidepost, their anchor for a lot of what they're doing. But he's started talking about how they're ready to start looking at the other shows of that same sort of era in terms of TV making, because he included Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and even Enterprise, which is part of that same production era.
And he's not just talking about he's already made references to all of these shows. I mean,
right.
The Janeway Maneuver. He's talking about telling stories like what he calls a Voyager-like story, Enterprise-like story, Deep Space Nine-like story. And, you know, we don't know what he means by that, but it sounds like they're looking to expand out from essentially doing a TNG Greatest Hits.
Right. And he also was talking about characters. He thought Mariner and Quark would get along really well, which I agree. She's got a bit of a Dax vibe sometimes, so I think they'd connect on that level.
Right. He's joking about how they could do a White Castle movie like Harold and Kumar,
yeah.
Except it would be Mariner and Quark. That might be kind of fun.
I would watch that.
She would definitely get along with Dax, mm-hmm. Although probably more... Maybe not as much Ezri Dax, who's the current DAX in this time frame.
Right. Like, I was thinking Jadzia, of course, but
of course. One last news, or a couple last news things. One is an update on something we mentioned last week, which is Star Trek Las Vegas has essentially changed its name. It's now called the 55-Year Mission. It's still run by Creation, and they just released a lot of their guests. I think they've released, this is for next August, like 80 guests. And
yeah, it's
the good
a huge
news-
list, and it covers every era, pretty much.
Including new shows. So there's going to be Picard people there. There's going to be Discovery people there. And then a lot of the legacy people, you know, from TNG and Voyager, etc. So,
and they still got Kelsey Grammer to confirm, which I think was a big deal when they announced it for the last.
Yeah.
The last one. But yeah, lots of new people too.
So it looks like going from official to unofficial really hasn't changed much except the name and logos and stuff like that.
Right. And, you know, they've built up relationships with a lot of those people over the years, too, which helps.
We're still waiting to hear if there's going to be an official con, something like Star Wars Celebration for Star Trek in 2021. I think that's possible, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's 2022. We don't know yet.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised either. Take some time to get everything in place and figure it all out.
The last bit of news is something we didn't actually cover on the site. We sent out a brief tweet about it. It's a little inside baseball, but it could be kind of important. And it is a corporate shakeup at ViacomCBS, where they've essentially restructured how they're doing streaming. And we're seeing a lot of the big companies do this. Disney last week announced that they're restructuring to focus on streaming. What ViacomCBS did is they put the guy in charge of Pluto, which is the number one ad-based streaming service in the world that Viacom bought a couple years ago. They put him in charge of all streaming, both ad-based and subscriber streaming, which includes CBS All Access and what's going to become Paramount Plus next year. And this is just the latest person being replaced in the chain of command of all the people who were in place when CBS All Access decided to make Star Trek their anchor show.
Right.
And so the people who brought in Alex Kurtzman and put that deal together, all of those people are now gone through various corporate shufflings, and this is just the latest. And one never knows with all corporate shufflings what this does to stuff in the pipeline. There's every indication, everything that the press releases say that they're committed to all the brands and the franchises. So, you know, things are probably still go, go, go for the multiple Star Trek shows on Paramount Plus coming in 2021, 22 through 2027, apparently. But this is just a bit of a one never knows.
Yeah, it creates a little uncertainty, maybe. Maybe
not. I tested the waters. I sent out a tweet last week to the new man in charge of the Star Trek universe, essentially. Alex's new boss, essentially. And he liked the tweet, and he has tweeted about Star Trek when it was on Pluto before. So
I was going to say Pluto has been very Star Trek friendly.
Right. Pluto partnered with TrekMovie.com to do a live blogging or live tweeting event a couple months ago. So they are happy to have Star Trek in their portfolio. They launched a Star Trek channel.
Yeah.
And there's more content coming to that channel. So
they do seem to understand that it has value.
Yeah, so I think it could be a good thing, actually. This guy built a great service that a lot of people love, and we'll see what happens.
All right. And I think that's the news. So
that's it.
I am ready to launch into our review of episode 2 of the 3rd season of Star Trek Discovery. What did you think overall, Tony? What are your sort of high-level notes?
Well, a lot of people keep on noting that the last episode was called Part 1, and a lot of Trekkies can't let go of the fact that this one isn't called Part 2. I've seen a surprising amount of commentary about that. So let's just pretend this is Part 2.
Right.
It's written by the same people, the same 3 writers, right?
Right.
So it's Lumet, Kurtzman, and Paradise. It's directed by Tunde.
Right.
It was also shot on location. This is a Part 2. They just decided not to call it Part 2. So just let go of that is all I have to say.
Unless there's a secret Part 2 coming later that tells us more about the time that Michael Burnham spends with Book.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either, but it's a possibility.
But it felt like, because what they did is they bifurcated the story, right? They said,
yeah.
Michael, we're going to do Michael here, and we're going to do everyone else here. And this is the everyone else story. I wouldn't say it's running in parallel, because this is technically after the Michael story, because there's a time jump, because, apparently the Discovery, it took them a year to show up. But it's kind of a parallel story where both are kind of experiencing the same thing. They pop out of a wormhole, they crash into an alien planet, and they deal with the locals.
And it's still everybody's first day.
Right, exactly. And except that this time it's not just Michael, it's everybody's first day.
Everybody. I hope they get a nap after, because it's just been exhausting for everyone.
I'd say I liked it. I think the opener was better. I think the opener certainly would work better for someone who wasn't already a fan of the show.
Yep.
Which is obviously on purpose, because if you watch that, you can kind of get into the show, and then you'll watch this one, and you may feel the need to start checking out some of season 2 and season 1 to figure out who's who and what's going on. I think you could probably follow it. I think it's hard to judge.
I was thinking that you could, like, I think the most confusing part, I think, is if you were watching, you would be like, who is that Georgiou person and what is she doing on the ship? But I think otherwise, if you were watching fresh and you watched last week's episode and this week's episode and you'd never seen Discovery before, I think you would be able to follow it. I think you'd be intrigued, and you'd want to go back and see what happened before, but you could move forward without it. That was the feeling I got.
That's probably true. I'll say that is true.
You're qualifying, but now you're right there.
Yeah, exactly. This felt familiar. Everything about this felt familiar, right? So they were kind of doing a traditional Discovery episode, but it still.
I don't think there is a traditional Discovery episode. I mean, honestly, I feel like this is setting a very new tone, and I liked it.
Well, I was going to say, it falls into a lot of familiar patterns with Discovery, so we have kind of a main story and a B story and a C story. But yes, there is a different tone, and there's some new themes. But we've still got Saru and Tilly kind of doing the plot with the planet, and you've got Stamets and Reno and a little bit of Culber having their B plot. So those kinds of things feel familiar, and it's obviously a familiar setting, the ship.
Yeah, I thought they made really good use of all of the characters, giving everybody a chance to do something. Really nice to see more of the bridge crew, which I think fans have been asking for, so they've been listening to that. I thought good use of sets, some familiar and some not, but just that we got to see them and be in them and they mattered, which is a very important piece of Star Trek. And I thought they set up their themes really nicely in a way that felt like it went with the story and wasn't so much stopping everything to say, here is one of our themes. I mean, they have moments, but I thought they did a nice job altogether. I was very happy as I was watching it. I had some issues here and there, moments that didn't feel quite as real or didn't quite make sense. But for the most part, I think it was great. I liked it.
Yeah, it's interesting if you compare this to the season opener of season two, where it really felt like they were doing some big changes. And looking at the first two or three episodes of season two, where they were really trying to, I think, fix things that they felt were just not working with the show. And this time, I don't think there are things that they were thinking were broken with the show. But I think there were certain things that they were tweaking. They were massaging. They were moving into a slightly different direction. Like Tilly, for example. So yeah. I feel like Tilly moved away from the cartoonishy stuff that she does and just felt more natural, more organic. And well,
she felt very real and very relatable. So the thing that people love about her is that you get that feeling of, wow, if I was in that moment, I'd be a little overwhelmed or I'd be excited. And this time I thought they made it work in a better, they don't need outlandish lines like the power of math, people, and things like that. But when she sniffs because she's scared or emotional, all of her responses I thought were so, I mean, I think she's a really good actress, but it felt very relatable and accessible and not like a punchline so much.
And the Taru, Saru, Tilly.
Taru.
Did I just create a couple name for them you accidentally? Did.
It's better than not... silly.
Fair enough. But they have a great mentoring relationship, which has been touched on, and we really got to see it come together in this episode.
It's funny. It's something that Doug Jones had talked about in interviews a long time ago, and they did it a little bit last season, but sometimes it was more like, oh, he's in charge of her training, or he's chastising her. And here, I felt like he was really mentoring her. He was understanding her. He was connecting with her and giving her more confidence in herself, just reminding her that she is strong and smart and useful and important. So I really loved all the scenes with the two of them in particular, and Saru in general too. But those scenes were great and again, seemed to integrate well with the action and the story.
And it also showed how he is a different kind of captain or acting captain.
Oh, yeah.
The way he, yeah, I mean, and no one can believe they even chose her to go on the away mission with him, including Tilly. She's like, don't take me.
Right. Why?
I'm a mess, you know?
She's like, thanks for taking me. Why did you take me? Basically.
So, yeah, so in many ways, he's demonstrating how he's stepping into the role of a commander and or a captain. And I mean, there's other little ways where you could compare how he is different than Michael. There was a subtle thing where, because remember, as the first episode started, the first thing Michael did is check to see if anyone was alive, right? And then she has this elation moment. Right?
Yes.
And when Saru finds out that there's life on this planet, there's this very subtle thing where he just says, there is life. And the way he says it was beautiful. And it showed this kind of dignity.
So I agree. And I thought that moment was powerful and strong. But then a second later, I thought they didn't tell anybody else. And I know that they didn't have ship-wide communications, so they couldn't make some announcement. But to me, that would be something you would want everybody to know right away to give them hope and feel good about what they just did. And I would have, and they're all paired up. You know, they have some method of sending information around. And I would have had a moment of spreading the word, because I feel like that's something everybody else wanted to know. Not to take away from that moment, which I agree with you was powerful. But that was a big omission, I felt.
I don't know. I put that in that's off-screen headcanon stuff. Like, of course they got the word out.
Well, you say of course, but it didn't happen.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure that Jean, the hazmat guy, was tasked with carrying that message from room to room after he cleaned up the spore chamber.
I don't think so. I disagree. I think it was an omission, and it would have been, you could have done it with one scene of just someone starting to spread the word. It seemed like a big secret to keep, but I agree. It was a nice moment for Saru. I liked his reaction to it.
Now, speaking of Gene, the hazmat guy who's credited as Ensign Hazmat.
Yes.
Who do you think has the better chemistry here? Stamets and Culber or Stamets and Reno?
Right now it's Stamets and Reno. Although, as much as I love her and I love her character, I felt like she had a little bit, and that actually specifically with that hazmat line, when he says, my name is Gene, actually, and she says, I've already forgotten that. She felt, I don't know if you're going to get this reference, Tony, because I'm not sure this show is in your lexicon, but I have a 13-year-old, so I've watched a lot of Glee. And that was a very Sue Sylvester kind of thing to say from Glee. I've already forgotten that. Like, I don't even care who you are, is the message, which felt a little bit harsh, but did remind me of Sue Sylvester.
Yeah. Well, I've never watched the show, but I know the actress.
Yeah, it's Jane Lynch.
And I can imagine her saying it. It does make sense.
Yeah, she gave people names all the time and didn't care what their real name was and made it clear that she wasn't interested in them. But I do think that Reno and Stamets, I hope we get a lot of them together. It's a very good duo.
Yeah, I mean, they could overdo it, but there was one episode where they really leaned into it last season. I think a lot of people liked it.
Yeah.
And this is, as I was saying, for this episode, they're like, okay, you liked this in season one, we're going to do more of that here. You didn't like this in season two, maybe we'll do a little less of that here. For example, there's that great moment where Tilly is about to say WTF, except she said the words and Saru cuts her off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that felt like the show was saying, we get it. F-bombs are a big deal. That, you know, swearing is swearing, saying, you know, shit, but there is a line, and for some people that's a big word, and it just feels weird to hear it in Star Trek.
It is jarring. I mean, it's never been a big deal to me, but it is very jarring to some people. And I think if there's not a reason to jar them, then I guess don't. Certainly not from such a small, insignificant thing.
Right.
So I agree. That was done very deliberately.
Although I wouldn't be surprised if we heard it. Like, but then it would be like such a big deal. Like, they want it. If we ever do hear it again, it will be for a good reason.
Right.
It'll.
It won't be just tossed around.
But I still liked the Stamets and Culber stuff because they just feel like such a natural couple, and they have, you know, even though they're dealing with some serious stuff, there's a lot of fun to it, and we're also seeing Culber be an actual doctor, and he uses a new cellular regeneration chamber.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, why build a set for a scene that lasts less than a minute? That thing's coming back, right?
Yeah, for 100% that's coming back.
Someone is going to get horribly scarred or burned or something. I mean, you don't make a set and then just use it for a throwaway scene. So.
Right. I mean, I did think, to me, I love when Culber's back and doing medical things, but I did feel like, you know, at the end of last season, they were about to basically split up, like as in physically split up, because they were going to be in two different locations. And then Paul gets injured. And so Hugh comes to save him. And then in that moment realizes, oh, I need to be with him. And then they quickly, I mean, this is all the same day, I guess. So they've quickly fallen into some very familiar banter without having to work their way back to each other. So a bit of a shortcut for my taste. But
it was the will they or won't they again stuff was just getting old in season two. I'm just glad that they're
I mean
they may not be done with it, but it's time to move on. I think, you know, especially because I'd rather see more of Culbert, because what they're showing in this episode, and we're jumping around from character to character,
sure.
But the important thing that Culber's going to be doing in this season is more doctoring and specifically some counseling,
which we got a hint of. Yeah.
Right. So we're this has all been telegraphed by the actor in various interviews, but you mentioned how some of the bridge crew are getting fleshed out. The person who got the most was Detmer. And I feel like Emily Coates really stepped up, because they gave her a lot to do in this episode. I mean, not a lot of screen time, but a lot of weight. They put a lot of weight on her, and they had her do it with stage directions. A lot of this wasn't even in dialogue, right?
Right. If you were looking down and just listening to dialogue, which some people watch TV that way, you would have missed what was happening with her.
Yeah. And what's happening with her is she's not coping. And if you think about everything that this crew's been through, it makes sense for some of them to not be handling it well.
And the weight of responsibility on her as the pilot, pretty much, was very heavy and affected her very strongly. When everybody's cheering because they've survived, she's just still... I mean, she was injured at that point, too, but she was just in a state. And when she goes to sick bay and gets repaired in 3 seconds and gets told you're good to go, she is so not good to go.
Right. Speaking of sick bay, I mean, I don't know if this is ghoulish of me to say, but I liked seeing the doctors with blood on their tunics and the frenzy in there. I mean, it felt like a real... triage crisis situation, which it was.
It was. In fact, I liked the dramatic transition when Culber took Stamets out of his coma, because we see Stamets and it's very quiet and it seems like he's by himself. And when he wakes him up, suddenly they reveal what's really going on in the room.
Yeah, that was some great work by Tunde in the way that was shot.
Yeah, very nicely done. It was created some drama in that moment.
So we had a C story here for Detmer, but it's obvious that what's going on is setting things up both for her and for Culber, where he's going to be a shrink basically for this crew and for her, hopefully soon.
Because... Yeah, he had that moment where she walked by and he was the only one who noticed. At least the only one in sick bay who noticed. I mean, on the bridge, they noticed because they know her well. But like, Owashikan and Tilly both sort of clocked that something was going on with her. But he noticed in a way that was very significant when nobody else was really getting it. Again, because they had so much other stuff to do. So they healed her and she was ready. But I think this is going to be a really fascinating thread. And Emily Coates is clearly up to the job.
I mean, there's a couple interesting ways they could go with this. I mean, one is she could just kind of, you know, maybe not everyone makes it. Maybe not everyone can cope with this future. You know, I can imagine some people might just want to leave. And then we have to think about what they did with Arium, you know, like when they start paying attention to a bridge crew member.
Oh,
you know, maybe they're about to get Ariumed.
Oh, no.
So let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, but I don't think they're gonna do that. I think they want to explore PTSD. I think that's their way of setting that up.
My favorite secondary character treatment in this episode was Nan, a character I really liked when they introduced her. She just kind of seemed cool, and it was fun to have a Barzan join. And then as season two progressed, and especially in the last couple episodes,
just
hated her. She was just the worst dialogue, so cartoonish. She was becoming this kind of protege of Giorgio's, cruel, sadistic. It was terrible. And Now, in you know, this is one of those things where, yeah, it's a day later and it doesn't make sense, but suddenly she seems to have her mojo back. She's able to stand up to Giorgio. She's kind of fun again. And I think they've totally recalibrated the character, and all for the better. So this is another one of those things where I think they realized they were going in the wrong direction and they just switched over.
Right. I mean, in season one, Landry at the beginning, people had a lot of issues. I know I did, with how she was just mean spirited. Like, she wasn't a good person and she seemed to be kind of cruel. And I am happy that they, you know, redirected Nan from that kind of behavior.
Right. I mean, also, Landry acted like someone from the Mirror Universe, even though she wasn't.
Right. Yeah. I also noticed the actress who plays Nan is in the opening credits now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so we'll be seeing a lot more of her, and that's good. That's good. So she's got something to do. Now, we mentioned, you know, we're jumping all over the place, but we've talked about Giorgio a couple times. And I don't know, do you want to talk about her?
Yeah, I mean, to me, she still feels like sort of an agenda item for the writers than anything else. I think the writers really enjoy writing for her, and I think they want to hold on to Michelle Yeoh because they're planning a Section 31 show and they just love her, and I get that. But I'm not a big fan of the character and that they let her come with them given who she is, who the Emperor is in her history. And it's helpful to have someone there for conflict, I guess, but the idea that she just is, I mean, it's in your review too, and I agree with you completely. I don't like the idea that someone has to do the dirty jobs for Starfleet and for the Federation, because part of the idealism of it is that you don't have to do those dirty jobs, that you find better ways of doing them. And she's gonna keep being her ridiculous self with her sort of overly written one-liners.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan. And it has nothing to do with Michelle Yeoh. It's that character and the fact that she was this brutal dictator and murderer and is now just walking around being sassy.
Yeah. It's, they don't know what to do with her. Saru doesn't know what to do with her.
He's good with her, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in a way, she was important in this episode because she was part of his growth, although they could have done that with anyone. But certainly the way he stood up to her, he held true to the Federation's ideals. But she still did sort of save them because he was about to give away like a whole bunch of dilithium and she came in and kicked everyone's ass. So
no, and Tilly was going to be sent out into the parasitic ice night.
Yeah. So they sort of needed her. And yeah, you're right. I don't want to see more of that.
Although I have a little nitpick. You're probably going to say it happened off screen. Okay. Should I bring it up?
Go ahead.
So before Sir and Tilly went out, they said, we have to go by sick bay and get some treatment so that we can breathe the air on the surface or whatever it was. And then, so wouldn't that have to be authorized for Giorgio to get that same? I was like, how did she get it?
Well, you know.
Why would somebody give it to her? If she went into sick bay and said, oh, I'm going to go on the surface, I'd be like, who on whose orders? I know it's dumb.
She hacked the computer. She found out.
I know.
You know,
it's tiny and dumb. I know.
There was a little hanging weirdness where we got a little Linus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's always delightful.
I'm a fan.
And he says something about his visual spectrum, and she seems to be fascinated by his visual spectrum. And she says, "Oh, we need to go talk." And so the whole episode, I was thinking, somehow she's going to trick Linus into doing some evil thing for her that has to do with him being able to see in certain spectrums.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
didn't she like take his arm before they walked off?
Yeah, it was kind of a nice, it was a nice little moment. I'm thinking this is going to be a little delicious. Maybe it won't be like a full evil thing, but something funny or interesting. And it was nothing. So maybe it'll get picked up in another episode, or maybe it was cutting room floor. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like it would have been a weird choice to just drop it after that. There's usually a reason. But you're right. They could have cut something.
Yeah. Now, getting back to Saru and Tilly, they were kind of driving the plot forward, and they essentially got to play Fistful of Data, right? So they had a little Western.
Right.
Right. Which, they go out.
For the record, not one of my favorite episodes. We did a Trek Movie does our Sunday viewing parties, and the week that we watched that one, I was just sitting there rolling my eyes a lot.
I mean, Star Trek was built on the concept of wagon train to the stars, and a lot of Star Wars and certainly The Mandalorian is built around this Western motif.
Well, science fiction is a Western in general because it's exploring a new frontier. I mean, that's really the evolution. It's the evolution of the Western in a way, because it takes it to brand new setting. And because it's not an American Western that has some kind of that has history, that's rooted in actual history, that, like, my issue with Westerns often is it's limiting. Like, you need mostly white men because that's who was mostly doing stuff back then. Women didn't get to do much. The settings were kind of limited. And so science fiction takes all of that, the same feeling of exploration of a Western, a new frontier, and establishing law and all of that into a huge palette. So I am disappointed when they shrink that palette down, which is pretty much what they did.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, so Saru is the white hat, he's so forgettable, I've already forgotten the name of the character. What's his name?
Oh, Zara? Yeah, something like that.
Whatever.
Yawn.
Let's just call him the bad guy. Is the black hat, I mean, he literally has spurs.
Yeah.
Why does he have spurs?
I don't know. He took a transporter. I don't know.
Well, no, he pulled up in a spaceship.
Yeah. No, but to get there, you have to.
Whatever. Yeah.
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 He was. My point is, he was not on a horse.
Right. Yeah, but he was just.
And even his entrance, like, didn't they start on his boots? He and his cohorts come in, and it's that cliched sort of, you know, let's see the boots first as they come in. On his way out, in his final exit, he spits before he leaves, which, of course, in the COVID era, that's very menacing, but there's no COVID there, so you don't have to. Yeah. But I was like, oh my God!
It was all very cliched. And
I think there are ways to play with those themes and play with that look, but don't just do it. Take it to another level. Like, if they'd given him a more alien look, even that would have helped a little.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the bar was straight out of a Western, and it's saloon doors. I mean, it's like they weren't really trying. There's ways to evoke the Western motif without just literally replicating the Western motif.
Yep.
So both of us had issues with the kind of over the top Westernness, but we did get a little bit of world building. We learned a little bit more about what's life like in the post burn world.
Certainly that it's lawless, which is the thing that they were trying to get across in both of these two episodes that we've seen. But in this one, you know, that he is able to completely control the population of a planet because he's the only courier.
Right.
And he did it by killing the previous courier and damaging their equipment.
Yeah. So these couriers, I mean, Book and Cosmo and all, you kind of just got the sense that those guys were kind of like freighter pilots and stuff, but maybe these couriers have a lot more power and influence than we realized. And, you know, they could control whole regions.
Right. If they're the only ones who can travel, then that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. They have territories and they're, you know, they're essentially gang leaders.
Right.
So it makes us now look back at Book and think, you know, does he have a territory? Is he, you know, considered one of these guys, or is it, you know, are there good couriers and bad couriers? It seems like he's a good courier. Obviously.
Yeah, of course he is.
But he did double cross Michael like almost immediately, so he's not that good.
Well, it wasn't. I don't think that was because I'm going to defend him always now. But
look, he did. You can't factor his hotness into his character.
You can, but. The point is, he didn't know who she was, and he just assumed she was just like everybody else that he seems to encounter. So I don't think it was so much that he was being bad, but that he was waiting for, he just wanted to beat her to it in terms of turning on the person that they're with. And then once he realized, oh, she's not a bad person, then he stopped.
Right. So, I mean, that's pretty much all I've got to say about the Western. They show up at the town. They set things right. They show the people that the Federation still exists out there. And so now these Cordonites, you know, can believe that, you know, there's a new sheriff in town. And although it's not clear that the Discovery will ever be back at this planet, and I kind of hope they don't, you know, because I want to see
something else
every week. Yeah,
right. Guys in a bar. I mean,
yeah,
that,
I don't want to see that bad guy ever again, even though Jake Weber's a good actor.
No, it's not the actor's fault, and I do, and since he's still alive, I just think, okay, we could totally run into him again, because why else do you let someone go? But I did like the whole, that Cal, poor Cal, the character who got brutally and slowly and painfully killed, I liked his whole sort of innocent belief in Starfleet and asking Tilly if she thinks he's Starfleet material, and how he got some courage just from their presence. Because I am still that. I'm a Starfleet idealist. And that's sometimes with Discovery, I haven't been happy with the way that they portrayed Starfleet. And so I liked that part of it. It reminded me of all the things I found aspirational about it as a kid.
And he inspired his brother to pick up that belief, even though,
right,
you know, in a way, Saru and Tilly were kind of responsible for his brother getting killed, and a little, you know, if right. they never showed up, his brother would have survived the day, right?
Right.
But they got some dilithium.
They got some dilithium, and he got to know that he was right, that his idealism was there for a reason.
Yeah. So
which doesn't help him now when he's dead, but. Was nice for a minute.
For a minute.
For a minute, and then boo. And then we have that weird Georgiou suddenly decides that she cares about this colony and gives Zara this threat about if he comes back and tries to mess with them.
Yeah, her morality meter just wildly fluctuates.
Like, she cares about Michael a lot, and then now she suddenly decided that that planet should be protected. It was, yeah.
Erratic. I mean, the whole reason why she even showed up is because she's obsessed about fixing the communications so that she could get in touch with Michael.
Right.
So, you know, she definitely cares about Michael a lot and still thinks of her as her daughter, even though logically she knows she's not her daughter.
Right. Michael has a lot of parents.
Yeah. It's not clear that she feels that way towards Georgiou, though.
So. No, although they teamed up a little bit in season two, but yes.
Out of convenience, but right. Certainly.
Right.
Now, probably the biggest thing that Mr. Space Spurs brought to the episode was he spoke in a pidgin version of the common tongue. So we, you know, heard that in this post-burn world that some people speak differently. And if you were listening closely, you heard a term that we've heard before, which is the Vedresh.
Which we heard in Calypso.
Exactly, which is the Short Treks episode written by Michael Chabon. I think a lot of people still consider it to be the best Short Treks.
I do. I mean, when that first aired, I watched it twice in a row. Like, as soon as I finished, I watched it again. I loved it.
And Even though I like it when short treks are somewhat linked to other things, like the Harry Mudd one, I always kind of liked thinking of this short treks as just its own thing. You know, it's just this beautiful little sci-fi story where you don't need to know anything about Discovery. They were just using the sets, and it was just an interesting little character story about this AI and this guy craft, and obviously it's a retelling of a Greek myth. So that was great. But now maybe it is all connected, man. Man, maybe it's like the dude's rug, right? It just put, you know, it just ties the room together.
Right. And so what we know in this timeline, the telling line that she says to Kraft in Calypso, is that she says she's been alone for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So that means 1,000 years after all of this happens, which is confusing about the role of...
I've got a crazy theory.
Okay, let's hear it. I love your crazy theories.
Okay, well, I mean, this is almost certainly not true, but maybe at some point the Discovery goes back to the 23rd century. And they abandoned the ship in some nebula so that Control can't find it. But this allows them to go home, back to their homes and their families. So this would be something that they do at the end of season 7. Right?
Okay. So then it's more like just 70 years ahead of them.
No. But then the ship stays in this nebula, and she, you know, Zora was rounding down, right? So, but it's roughly 1,000 years. It's more like 900. So basically the ship goes back, and then is 1,000 years old again in the 32nd century. See what I'm saying?
Yep.
So that Calypso didn't take place in the 42nd century or beyond. It did take place maybe in the 32nd or 33rd. So that's crazy theory number one. Because, see, if it's not that, then we go, okay, well, so 1,000 years. So they're already calling the Federation the Vedrash, and they're still calling the Federation the Vedrash in 1,000 years, which would mean that their whole goal of this season, the stated goal of the season, is to put the Federation back together again.
Right.
So
that kind of implies they don't quite succeed.
Yeah. You know, and because Kraft is at war with the Federation. So is that the kind of Federation we want to believe in, that it's this warlike Vedrash thing?
Or that there are still myths about it that are inaccurate? Yeah.
So, I don't know. This is a big head scratcher right now.
Raises a lot of questions.
Yeah. I'm not sure they have the answers. I think they're just borrowing the word from Calypso. They're not going to try to make Calypso fit.
I tend to agree.
And which is crazy, you know. So that's practical thing. Because my other crazy idea is that they do fix the Federation, but there's another Federation. So the Federation splits apart like the Roman Empire split into two pieces. And there's a good Federation and a bad Federation. And the bad Federation is the Vedrash, and the good Federation is the one Michael rebuilds.
I don't think I want to watch that show.
Yeah. So,
I mean, Universe, right? Like, it's the same kind of concept.
Right. But these are the kind of hoops you have to jump into to make Zora's line about she's been alone for 1,000 years. Unless she was in some kind of accelerated time bubble. I mean, there's some Star Trek, you know, crazy science where you can make it work. You know, like that planet in Voyager that, what was it called? Blink of an Eye?
Blink of an Eye with Daniel Day Kim.
God. I can't believe I remembered the name.
I'm impressed. I gotta say, I'm impressed.
I really love that episode.
It's a great episode. Interesting concept. But yeah. So anyway, separate from all of that, that was the one stumbling block in our world building so far.
Well, and another piece of world building is we finally got the name of something that we talked about a lot last episode. We kept on referring to it as smart matter.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why, because we knew it was called programmable matter, but both of us forgot because we were so tired.
It was a tough week last week.
Anyway, so we learned a little bit more about programmable matter this week. It seems to be ubiquitous. So even here, like these guys, the way they talked about it, it's like, well, yeah, it's programmable matter. Everyone's got it. But it has limitations, which is good because I don't like magical technology, like the Picard ocarina of believe what you want and you could have it thing.
Right.
Where you need a template or a program, you know, because it is programmable matter, so you need a program. You can't just make anything. You know, you need to have a plan. Or you know, the joke that Tilly says is you can't, what's the
something the about gazpacho and peach something
yeah.
there?
Yeah. Right. So I feel like that's going to play out later where they're going to need to, you know, I've played enough video games to know what a fetch quest. Have you ever heard the term fetch quest?
No.
Okay. Well, it's a video game term. It means, you know, if you need to get to point B, but you need to get item A and plug that into element C to get to point B. So I feel like at some point they're going to need to get a program to build a thing, to do a thing. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. And this is our first.
Take them on a crazy adventure.
Exactly. And I like that they're showing us that this is a different world. And there are some different rules to this world, which is good. It's
yes.
not just, you know, slightly different. Because, I mean, this is, you know, I'm going to slam Enterprise now. Warning, you know, Reed Alert. Which was one of the names that Reed thought they should use for Red Alert when he was trying to invent Red Alert. But one of the problems with Voyager and Enterprise was that Enterprise felt too much like Voyager. Like, oh, well, this ship doesn't have shields. But then, you know, they just polarize the hull plating, and the hull plating polarization is at 50%. They just change the word. You know, it's still essentially shields. You know, so they didn't change the rules enough. I mean, I do like Enterprise, but it's great when we see things that make this world that they live in feel differently. And the more they can do that, the better.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But this gets to kind of a bigger issue of Discovery itself, which is this whole point of this season is, as Michelle Paradise says, fresh snow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've done a radical thing. They've moved the show into an entirely new space. So let's see him use it. Let's see. You've got a blank canvas for the most part, and hopefully they take advantage of that. And I've seen a lot of good indications that they are. Some indications of them falling back into some bad habits. So, you know, I'm not worried yet.
I'm tentatively optimistic.
Check in a couple weeks.
Yes.
And we'll see if they stay on course to live up to the ideals of having this fresh snow and being a new show. I'm not saying that they need to change everything about Discovery, but, you know, let's take advantage of the opportunities, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. And Saru actually says it out loud for his crew, but also I think for viewers, when he says, I know that we all want to see what's out there, but first we have to deal with what's in here. So I felt like that was a message to me personally, no, to all of us watching as well, which is, yes, we're going to get to see where we are and what this world is, but this episode is going to focus on Discovery itself.
fixing the ship and giving us little updates on all the characters, which I think is what the episode was really about.
Yes, and they did it, I thought, for the most part, very well.
And it looked great. Especially that opening was just...
The landing, the crash landing was great. All of those scenes of the ship were just gorgeous to look at.
I'm calling it best crash landing of the franchise. What do you think?
Oh, of the whole franchise?
Whole franchise, including the rolling Cerritos from Mariner's Fake movie.
But I think the one in, is it Generations? I think I have a special love of that crash.
I still think it.
I think that that to me, the way it's pushing up the land, that was amazing to me. I remember being stunned by it.
Well, I guess the problem with that one is it just everyone's just along for the ride. I enjoyed the bridge scenes during the crash landing.
Yes,
I thought that was done better here.
Sure.
And the way the bridge was working together. So no, I thought it was all very well done. There was a lot of great technobabble. It was just a great scene and just incredible effects.
Yes, I agree. So how about the best crash on the inside in terms of the effects? But the weight of the Enterprise pushing up the land to me was very impactful in that movie. But this was, I mean, I don't want to take away from this. So it was, I thought they filmed it beautifully. It looked good. It was intense. It was powerful.
You know, it's easy to look at these effect shots, these big effect shots like that. But what Discovery does great with a lot of the effects is there's so many effects going on, you don't even notice it. But it really helps sell this future. So, you know, the way Linus's eyes blink, the way that the smart matter gets built. It's the stuff they build into every scene, and costs a lot of money, obviously. But I think that more than any other Star Trek show, I'll be curious if Strange New Worlds has this level of special effects, because it's very impressive.
Yeah, I agree.
And well, of course, there's special effects apparently that we don't even know are happening, and we've heard a little bit about this before, where they look at something in post production and they have the special effects teams fix stuff. Just little things on the set. I'm not saying that this has happened, but you know, if someone left a coffee cup on a table, they could remove that kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, I've heard they've changed the color of a floor once just because afterwards they decided they didn't like it.
They've gone in and changed colors of plants before and things like that also.
Yeah, things that you'd never notice. But this season they're doing it at a new level because there's something that they every show does this where they do things called pickups or inserts where you get a reaction shot from someone or just little things that you need to put in an episode that you don't realize you need until months later. But now they can't shoot those things. And so they're doing them digitally and they're having the actors perform things with motion capture suits because they've scanned every actor from head to toe. And so there'll be things we see all season that we'll never know were digital.
Right.
You know, it could be a couple seconds here, half a second there. And those are the kind of really impressive things that, you know, the quiet moments, as it were.
Yep. Do you have favorite moments that you want to call out from the episode?
I mentioned a few. I mean, you know, everything with Jet and Stamets is fantastic. You know,
I clocked nicknames. A couple of her nicknames. I got four of them.
Go ahead. What were they?
Sunshine, Hazmat,
right?
Crazy
right.
Pants, my favorite was Crazy Pants, and Bobcat.
Yeah.
So she's like the Sawyer from Lost. She's like the Sawyer of Star Trek Discovery because she gives nicknames. She just hands them out, throws them around.
Maybe we should create a Jet Reno nickname generator.
Like they had for Sawyer. We covered a lot of mine. There was just a funny moment where when they get their weapons drawn on them in the bar and Tilly says, "My name lacks authority." And he says, "What?" And she goes, "What?" Which made me laugh. I'm a sucker for Tilly. I think she's great. I was so, when that fight started, I'm not a big fan of fights and especially cliched fights, but I will admit that I was sitting on my couch watching going, "Quills, quills, quills, quills," waiting for the quills. So when the quills came, when Saru shot out those quills, I applauded. I've been wanting, yes. I'm a big fan of the quills. I also thought that the payoff at the end with Michael appearing on the screen was, even though it was a little slow, that they're like, "What are we going to do? Let's answer the hail." And then it took a long time to bring it up.
Please tell me that was so obvious it was coming.
No, it wasn't a surprise, but it was a beautiful moment anyway, I thought.
No, it was. It was.
So,
the
fake suspense made it more obvious because of how slowly they did it. Because they're hailing us, "What should we do?" just seemed very out of character for everybody. But the moment where she sees him and she says his name and everybody responds and she tells them how long it's been, I just thought was, they do so, you know, a lot of our criticism of previous episodes is unearned big emotional moments, and this was very earned.
Yeah, everything led up to that, and
I'm glad they didn't make us wait one more episode. I mean, we'll get our reunion, but it was nice to actually have it happen now.
Yeah, and yet they still had their own episode. They didn't need Michael for an episode, although she did save them in the end, pulled them out of the ice. But they could have probably made it, right?
Yep. We don't know if they were going to make it or not. They could have. But it worked for me.
And so, that in a way that perfectly shows us how this was a two-part episode, right? So now we've come full circle.
Right. And it wasn't like, it wasn't like last season where we spent half the season just thinking we were going to see Spock and not seeing him. So this time they just said, "Okay, this suspense part is done. We know they're back together now. And we can move on and start telling the rest of the story."
Of course, we knew all that because Jonathan Frakes told us.
Right, but he didn't tell us that they would connect at the end of episode 2.
No. He said they get reunited in episode 3, which is next week, which is his episode that he directed. So we know, according to him, there'll be a lot of hugging in episode 303.
I am very pro hugging. Bring it on.
Yes.
I miss hugging.
We all do. So this is the best we could get, is watching people do it on TV.
Well, I have some teenagers who allow me to hug them sometimes, so.
So I think that's it. We're just excited about next week's episode. It was a good episode. All in all, if you look at them as a package, I think it was a great start.
Yes.
Certainly better than season 1. And
I'm going to say better than season 2.
I would say it's probably the second episode of season 2 is when they go to the church, right?
Yeah.
That was a strong episode. It also directed by Jonathan Frakes. I'm going to say I feel equalish. That was when I was still very jazzed about season 2. So I'm still very jazzed about season 3.
Yeah, so am I. I'm excited for it, and I feel like they're on a good path, and I hope that they continue to do the good stuff and less of the bad.
I'm more excited about the exploration of the Federation and what's happened to them than I was about the whole Red Angel jazz.
Yes, definitely. And again, live up to their name, Star Trek Discovery. I'm ready to go discover things, not dig into someone's past. You know, that's always, it has to do with something that happened a long time ago. No, no. How about something that's happening now right in front of us?
Yeah. So before we wrap up the show, we have, we like to do our little Trek bits. And do you have a Trek bit this week?
I do. One of our Trek movie contributors is Neil Shirley, who has become, he's a friend of mine. I've never met him in person, actually, but I feel like he's my friend. We met on Twitter. We have kids the same age. We have spouses who roll their eyes when Star Trek items arrive at the home. So we have a lot in common. And he does this great newsletter that I think all Star Trek fans would really enjoy. It's called Star Trekking. It comes out every Tuesday. And the conceit of it is that he finds references to Star Trek constantly in everyday life, even when he's not watching it or reading about it or connected to it. So sometimes it's something his kids do, it's something else he's reading, it's something he sees on the web. So he pulls all these references together. He puts together his favorite Trek-related tweets or videos or things that he's seen. He has the artist. This is one of my favorite Star Trek fan artists is Lee Sargent. I'm sure most people know his work. We'll put a link to his Twitter account as well, but does these great little cartoons. And so he has a column in Neil's newsletter called Art Trek Tuesday, where he talks about the inspiration behind his drawings. And then he always has some links at the end. The tone is always very upbeat and positive. I like Neil's writing so much. So we're going to put a link to it. And I recommend that everybody subscribe to it. For me, I get it on Tuesdays. I'm often busy with other things, and I put it I mark it to look at later when I need a break and like a delicious snack. And that's my break. So that's
it's a great newsletter.
Yeah.
I became aware of it just through Twitter as well. And, I try to read it as often as possible. And I'm so glad that he's become part of the Trek movie family as well.
Yeah, me too. And we'll get him on the podcast at some point. Okay. So, what's yours, Tony?
Well, mine's related to something. Last week, we put up an article about something called The Creator, which is this script that won a screenwriting contest for the Downtown Los Angeles Film Festival. And they're putting on this, they put on this reading, script reading last night. And it was staged on Zoom, but they did it in costume. And it's the story of how Star Trek was created by Gene Roddenberry and working with Lucille Ball, and it goes way back into kind of the origins of the show. And it's really a story about, you know, Gene fighting to get the show he wanted, and it's pretty interesting. And there was a character in it I wasn't familiar with, a guy named Alden Schwimmer, and so I was searching around and I found this thing on the website Letters of Note. We'll put a link in the show notes. And it's a letter written by Gene Roddenberry in 1965 after NBC has not made a final decision about the first pilot, The Cage. And this is Gene Roddenberry kind of worrying about what's going to happen next with Star Trek. He's poured his heart and soul into it. And what's beautiful about this is he's pushing his agent to not compromise and to stick to the vision. And he's, you know, he says he's okay if they just don't like it, but he doesn't want to lose what the show is. Because he says things in it like, we have an opportunity like Gulliver's Travel of a century or more ago to combine spectacle excitement to a mass group along with meaningful drama and something of substance and pride. And one of the funny things he says is he hates the idea of network notes. So when he's saying hearing back from the studio, he says he's wide open to criticisms and suggestions, but not from those who think answers lie in things like giving someone aboard a dog or adding a cute 11-year-old boy to the crew.
Visionary indeed. Yes. And also, that's a tough stance to take. I mean, he was right, but it's a tough one because most people, they go in and pitch shows. And when they go, okay, how about we get the dog? And they'll be like, okay, because they want to sell their show.
Yeah, that's what I found interesting is Gene saying, hold the line.
Yeah.
Don't sell out. Don't, you know, do anything the network says to do. I guess maybe this is why that they ended up doing another pilot.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing origin story that, you know, Star Trek anyway, already rare to begin with, but the letter's great.
So that's it for this week of All Access Star Trek.
But we'll be back next week. Don't fret. Don't fear.
Every Friday, we're back with the latest news in the world of the Star Trek universe on television and
reviews of new episodes as they happen.
And next week, one's happening, right?
Yes. Jonathan Frakes directing.
Number one, two takes Frakes.
All right. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. And please, please leave us feedback. I will beg you again. More feedback, please.
And you can leave feedback on the site or on Apple Podcasts. You could, you know, give us the 5 stars, of course, but you can also type in a review on the Apple Podcasts, and those things really do help. So please, please, please give us feedback, and we are listening, and we are doing everything we can to make the show better for you every week.
We are. All right. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.